You're listening to Dark City Radio Live, and this is your host Dawn from the Dark City crew. Tune in at www.darkcityradio.com. You can find us by searching Dark City Radio on Facebook or Twitter. Welcome to Dawn's Diorama. It's Sunday, April 28th, and this week on the show, I'm joined by Max Bliss, who's a chemtrail and harp activist and researcher. Max travels around with a lot of like-minded folks on his campaign of activism against the chemtrails with his chug-a-boom van. He spreads awareness of the dangers of chemtrails, and Max can be found under Mr. Max Bliss on YouTube, Facebook, and on WordPress. So he's all over the place, basically. So Max is joining me to discuss, as I've just mentioned, chemtrails, and also we'll be touching on harp as well and how they relate to each other. And he'll be talking about the work he and others have been doing to expose and stand against this practice. Max, welcome to the show. How are you this evening?
Hi, Dawn. Thanks for having me. I'm fine, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. So can we start maybe just by going back to the beginning, as I usually do? I like to ask my guests a little about yourself, and because I'm interested in your background and what happened that led you to getting involved in particular with the research of chemtrails and harp.
To give you, I suppose, a little, in a nutshell, my life. I left school very early and I joined the army for a couple of years. And then I decided, through my experiences, to go AWOL for 6 years. But whilst I was in the army, I did attend a lecture about the woodpecker, which is a similar technology to harp, which is a device that is used for mind control. So that was my first understanding about stuff that was going on. But then I left all that. About 10 years later, 10 years ago, I was working for an author who was a researcher into harp. And so I got given a book from her, and I did learn a little bit more about it. But then I kind of left it and carried on my life. And I've been working as a builder for 20 years, I suppose. And basically outside, weather dependent, always been aware of what's going on in the environment. Always been interested in nature, always enjoyed being outside, and I started to notice chemtrails, which strangely enough, I really only noticed them last year, if I'm honest. So about 1 year ago was the time I realized that something strange was going on in the sky, and I hadn't seen this before. Now, when I was a lad growing up, I grew up in Brighton, which is only 25 miles from one of the busiest airports in the UK. So I was always working around there when I was growing up. And I never saw trails in the sky. And when I started to look into chemtrails, I was absolutely convinced. I knew that these were new and unusual and strange. And I'd even wondered why I hadn't noticed them before. But I did start to research them, and I started to video them, started to post them to YouTube. And I got a lot of feedback from people. They liked my videos, and I just happened to live in an area where there's a lot of chemtrailing going on. And when I was researching the information, I seemed to be sharing information that people resonated with, and they felt that I was steering away from the disinformation and really cutting to the chase, and being fortunate enough to find information that seemed very relevant. And I started to get a following, so that's how I ended up becoming an activist, because I think once you start to realise how real this is and that you lose all the doubt, you realise you have to do something, because when you delve into this, you realise that the government are involved and you can't turn to them for help. So you kind of, well, as you delve into the community, you start realising that you need to raise awareness. That's it, ultimately, in a nutshell. So that's how I've got involved.
Okay, I mean, that's quite logical progression to get to that point, yeah. Now, can we go? You did mention Project Woodpecker, so I just wanted to go back to that, because I'm not sure if you're aware of the connection between a scientist. I'm just going to read something out here. Original research concerning the electron cyclotron resonance heating method was done by Nikola Tesla, and later expanded upon by not only Soviet scientists but also by US scientists such as Bernard J. Eastland, who's a scientist who happens to be associated with ARCO, the Atlantic Richfield Oil Company. Now, the reason I brought that up is because ARCO, we had a conversation off air about like secret societies and whatnot, and it triggered my memory about that. And ARCO has traditionally been controlled, but apparently, by members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And I, in particular, remember you saying something about the Knights of Malta in relation to that. Maybe.
Well, a lot of people who have been researching the Council on Foreign Relations have suggested that it's run by the Knights of Malta, and that the Council on Foreign Relations, basically, they make all the policy, the foreign policy, they make policy for the United States government. And even, I think I've posted a video of Hillary Clinton talking about how the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, actually write all the policy, and that she was so glad that they built a new office down in Washington, so that they didn't have so far to go when they were doing something wrong. So, yeah, I think they're very, very closely related with chemtrails, with HAARP,
yeah,
with the whole massive program that's going on.
Right.
Nothing goes on in the United States without the Council of Foreign Relations having a significant role in it.
Okay. Before we really go into what HAARP is and all that kind of stuff, I'd like to speak to you about chemtrails. Now, can you tell us what are contrails and what are chemtrails, and explain the difference between the two, how people can tell them apart?
Yeah, well, basically, a contrail is something that's formed behind an aeroplane at specific conditions. It usually has to be above 30,000 feet, or I think that's about 10,000 meters or 8,000 meters, which basically what it means is it has to be pretty high altitude. Not every plane can make one of these, and the temperature has to be below minus 35 degrees Celsius, and the humidity also has to be fairly the right conditions. So it basically, to form a contrail, it has to be quite specific conditions, and they're actually quite rare. Now, if you imagine on basically it's condensation. It's the hot exhaust hitting very cold atmosphere and turning the ice crystals. It changes them so that you actually see it, but it should return to normal in a very short period of time. It's pretty much like breathing out on a very cold day, and you'll get your breath coming out as a condensation trail, but it disappears afterwards because you've stopped talking or moved away or whatever. So it's pretty much like, once the plane's left that immediate area because it's traveling forward, the atmospheric conditions return to normal. So it shouldn't persist, you know, because the heat source all gone, it's all gone. So it just returns back to normal. And that's what we always used to see. And funny enough, I was just talking to a pilot earlier on, just before I talked to you, and she was very concerned about chemtrails. And she was explaining that she's been flying since she was 1973. And, you know, that she's now very concerned about it because she clearly knows the difference between what a contrail is and what a chemtrail is. Now, a chemtrail is, it initially looks like a contrail because it's coming out the back of a plane, but it can be very, very long, and it can actually be sort of thicker and more brilliantly coloured. You can notice the difference, but mostly it's the length, really, that will catch once you become aware of what a chemtrail is. It's how long they are, and sometimes they're just switched on and off, and you can see that if you're watching the plane. And sometimes they form specific shapes in the sky, like X's. You'll notice there's a great big X in the sky, or different grids in the sky, and we never used to see these massive visual statements in the sky before.
Looks out of place, doesn't it? Yeah, it's quite disturbing. No. Actually, my friend Dan Bedondi, I've actually had him on here before, but he's a pilot, and he knows like lots of other pilots, obviously, and like military pilots and whatnot. He spoke to them about all of this, and they back up what he says. You know, like, he totally believes in chemtrails, and they believe in chemtrails. And so, as far as I'm concerned, there's no doubt in my mind that chemtrails definitely exist. I mean, all people need to do is, as you've said, just open their eyes, look up at the sky. You know, there's so much evidence out there. There's patents and whatnot. Anyway, before we go into all of that, obviously, I want to ask you, what kind of things, what kind of chemicals are in these chemtrails, or are being used for the chemtrails, are you aware of?
Okay, well, I think most people, when they start looking into chemtrails, at some point they will come across the various list of patents, and one of them is the Welsbach's patent, and that is specifically tailor-made for geoengineering. And when you look into geoengineering, you will come across a documentary called What in the World Are They Spraying? Or Why in the World Are They Spraying? Now, these guys in the first one, What in the World Are They Spraying? They will talk about what might in the sprays. And so they look at the patents and they identify what they say they were using the patents. And they talk about aluminium oxide. They talk about barium salts. And they talk about strontium. And there are various other metals, magnesium, titanium, iron, copper, zinc, arsenic, cadmium, chromium. There are many, many different heavy metals, and thorium, with different uses. So basically, when you start looking into this, you start thinking, well, what can I do to find out if this is true? So what I did personally was take a sample of rainwater and have it analysed at my local government laboratory, which I've actually I've since had other tests done at different independent laboratories. But actually, it seemed to be a legitimate sample. And so, you know, basically, we're coming back with excessively high amounts of aluminium, barium, strontium, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, and you know, this confirms these levels. When you start looking at different the normal levels, you realise they're excessively high. You know, really ridiculously high. In some cases, yeah, Thousands of times higher than they should be. Yeah, and so at these levels, they're very, very toxic.
There's a lot of evidence out there, as you're saying, about these chemtrails being in existence. Now, there's been attempts to defend the geoengineering agenda of chemtrail spraying by stating that the chemtrails form a reflective shield against global warming. What would be your take on this?
Well, I've looked into, obviously, you will end up, if you start becoming interested in chemtrails and want to find out about geoengineering, you will eventually come across that geoengineering is a program that they've been researching to possibly counteract global warming. Now, global warming, when I started to look into this, I remembered the various little books that you would get in W.H. Smith's at the counter. There would be some My Little Earth book or whatever, and there were all these different little books pumped out to try and tell us about what danger we were living in. And I remembered the 1992 Earth Summit, and basically how there was this huge problem about global warming. Now, as you start to look into it, you start to realise it's a fraud, and that basically the Earth will go through cycles of change just like every other planet in our solar system. And basically, if we look at our recent history, it's quite easy to verify that, for example, the Vikings were growing barley in Greenland up until the 13th century. Now, there's no way that could be done now, but there was a mini ice age in the Middle Ages. And that's why the Vikings actually started to go and expand anyway, because they had to, because they lived in the northern part of the northern hemisphere, and it was far too cold to carry on surviving. So basically, there's evidence that the climate goes through changes, and it's got nothing to do with the anthropogenic activities of man. We're not changing the environment. The planet is going through changes anyway. And if now, when scientists look at the activity of the sun, and we can see changes going on in our planet, we can also see changes going on in other planets within our solar system as well. So there's absolutely no water that this whole idea that our planet is changing because of our activity. I think we can all resonate with the idea that there's lots of toxins going into the environment and there's lots of effects we are having. Yeah, of course, I don't deny that. But I don't believe that the significant changes they're trying to frighten everyone with, it's all about fear, are significant and real. And I think that science is now proving that. And we've also had the ClimateGate scandal at the university, at the UK Climate Research Centre at the University of East Anglia. Their accounts, their emails were hacked, and it was exposed that for many years they had been skewing the data and trying to make the data fit a model that suited the global warming hoax. So, you know, the government doesn't even talk about global warming in that same way now. They talk about it as climate change. So they're starting to change the tactics, but they've obviously invested a lot in this program and carrying on with it. But there's no way that global warming is true. And in fact, if you start to research it a little bit, you will find that you'll come across the Club of Rome, which is an NGO. It's a non-government organization that basically was given the task to come up with a unifying problem that would bring all the world's governments together. And I haven't got a quote of it right now. I can't remember it off the top of my head. But basically, they said that the activities of man on this planet was a threat to the planet, and there are limited resources and we're using too much resources, and the way that we're operating is causing problem, and we're responsible for global warming. And it's just a made up plan. It's because there's a much bigger agenda. And basically geoengineering is their program to combat this supposed global warming, but that's not the real reason at all.
Yeah. So let's go back. You did mention a little about the tests and that you'd done. Can we go into a bit more detail about the kind of tests that you'd done, what kind of tests you'd done to find evidence of the chemtrail spraying? And can you also tell us what other tests you might be aware of that you might not have tried? Found from them? What kind of results you were finding?
Well, I'll give you an example of how much higher than normal. If you have to understand that aluminium in the air, even in an industrial urban area, should only be 0.008 micrograms per litre. Now, that's quite a small amount because aluminium shouldn't be in the atmosphere. But with this laboratory test here, which is a legitimate result, is 740 micrograms per litre. Now, if you multiply 0.008 into 740, you'll see how many times above normal it actually is. It's huge. But to give you an idea of whether or not that's a danger to your health, when you start researching geoengineering, you will come across some professors, one called David Keith and the other one called Ken Caldera. And I think there are some others, but they're the ones that sort of take the limelight and do the tours and try to raise support for geoengineering. Now, they've been questioned as to the possible health impacts and the environmental impacts of spraying so many megatons of aluminium into the atmosphere along with the other ingredients. And they have said that they have not done any research into the health impacts, and they categorically state that they make sure that they point out they do not know. They say they don't know about the health impacts of spraying that much aluminium. Now, I know that's a lie because I have a document from the Wright-Patterson Air Force Laboratory, and that's in the US, and it's a research lab.
Can we
from
get
the US
link?
Air Force.
Do you actually have a website link for that? That you can maybe
actually on my WordPress. I think the last blog that I put up there on mrmaxbliss.wordpress.com, I've got a reference to the document itself, which you can print out. And basically, in this document, it says that just 5 micrograms of aluminium is sufficient to damage the alveoli, just damage the normal function of your lungs, basically, and impair your immune system. So basically, as you breathe in a very small amount, like 5 micrograms is very small, but the normal amount is 0.008 per litre. So when you get a rainwater analysis that's 740, you know that there are serious health impacts. So you only have to start looking for the increases of respiratory illnesses. For example, lung cancer has risen dramatically. And one of the key stimulants for the lung cancer is cadmium, which in its aerosol form is very carcinogenic. Now that's also much higher than normal. But aluminium is linked to Alzheimer's, and I think most people will realise Alzheimer's has increased a great deal. Many people are getting that now compared to the past. And there are many, many illnesses actually that are linked to what they are spraying or what we're finding in rainfall. Now the significance of finding it in the rainfall means that these ingredients can only get there at the point of nucleation during the process of precipitation. So it's up there in the atmosphere and it shouldn't be there. So, you know, the fact that they've done so much research on geoengineering and other research into other weather modification and to weather weaponry, it's quite clear that we can find all these documents. It's quite clear there's a lot of research done into this, and the fact that we're finding it and the fact we can see all these strange things going on in the sky we never saw before, I think it's quite easy to start to realise it's actually happening. And I have actually found a report in the Daily Mail about hailstones being having viruses and bacteria in them. Now, when you think about it, the viruses and bacteria shouldn't be up there at the point of nucleation for hailstones. It's usually much higher. That's why they can, with hailstones, it really has, the ice process has to go at quite a high altitude. So the fact that you've got viruses and bacteria up there, which has been proved not just from the Daily Mail's article, but many other scientific journals and other articles. There are things in our atmosphere that just should not be there at that altitude.
Absolutely.
So how are they getting there?
Yeah. There's also, I mean, the people who are having complaints of, like, breathing problems. There's an increase in breathing issues and people getting Morgellons.
Well, Morgellons, so that is... I didn't address your question properly. When you asked me what tests I would like to have done, I would really like to have I tried to get my blood tested, and you won't believe what difficulties I had trying to get my blood tested for heavy metals. And it even got to the stage where I had 3 samples taken, because that's what they require, 3 different samples. And I sent them off to an independent laboratory in Germany, and through some sort of complicated problems with mix-ups and everything else, we had a few phone calls and couldn't understand why. The following couple of days later, we were expecting the results, and actually they just sent my blood back and they didn't want to do the tests. So I would like to get that tested, because other people have had it tested and found that their blood is spiking and everything else. Some people get their hair tested, and a lot of people have had this done and showing extremely high amounts of heavy metals. But as far as Morgellons is concerned, I would like to have my blood tested for nanotechnology, because there have been many scientists now that are researching into Morgellons, and they are finding out. See, the thing is that when you research into chemtrails, you find out that there's quite a lot of information about smart dust and technologies called MEMS and GEMS, which we've talked about, for weather communication. For basically what they want to do is put these tiny little nanotechnology particles into the atmosphere. Now, you can have 30,000 of these on the head of a pin. These are minute, almost atomic-level nanotechnology devices.
That's very, very disturbing.
Well, the thing is, they talked about this in the 90s. This isn't even new technology. They've been thinking about this for a long time. Now, I'll give you a quick little hint, but, you know, I'm not saying they are doing it, but here's a link I found by accident, that General Electric, they make They just merged recently with Hitachi Electronics, which is a major, massive electronics company. They make aeroplane engines. They also make smart meters, which are something we might touch on later. And they also make smart dust. Now, smart dust is the nanotechnology that they talked about in the 1990s, which are MEMS and GEMS, which are these tiny little nanotechnology that basically communicate with each other and create a grid in the atmosphere. So, you know, there's one company there that makes the whole lot. And, you know, I think they might be linked, but I'm not saying they definitely are, but it's certainly an interesting connection. But smart dust is very real. It's nanotechnology has been around for a lot longer than many people realize. It's been around for 50 years. In fact, it's the same as with HARP. And like you touched on earlier on, Nikola Tesla, he was the main inventor of HARP. And and he died towards the end of the Second World War. And when he died, a lot of his information was destroyed. And he had over 700 patents that hadn't been explored, and they were confiscated by the CIA, or by, not the CIA because they didn't exist then, but by the US Secret Service or whatever it was at that time. And basically, Tesla had, before he died, realized about the implications of his inventions or his patents, and he had sent some of that technology to different nations so that no one nation would have that technology in one go, supposedly. But it's quite amazing that this technology, it appears nanotechnology, it all appears to be new, but it's not new at all.
Absolutely. The military are apparently ahead of us by decades. And like what they've released to the public with their technology. But can we, like, from the results of these tests that you've developed, chembusters, right? So can we maybe talk about them, about what the chembusters, what they're doing, like how do they actually work?
Okay, well, basically, I think as my journey down the chemtrail route continued, and I became utterly convinced of the reality of the situation, you know, you go through lots of different emotions. You can get quite depressed, you can get quite sad, you can get quite angry, you can get, it's quite frightening, you know, you go through all these different things. And I wanted to do something. I didn't want to feel powerless. I didn't want to feel like I was living in fear, and I wanted to become more positive and more proactive about doing something. So I started to research what could we do, and I came across something about chembusters. And basically, the more I looked into it, it seemed a little bit of a leap of faith for me. It seemed like backyard science. It seemed a bit like, you know, some mad inventor making something, and could it really work? And I came across this site about the Orgon laboratory, something like that, and because Orgon is an energy and it's linked to chembusters. And basically, when I was reading this Orgon laboratory site, at the end of the site, it talked about chembusters and saying that chembusters are dangerous, and if you had one, you should try to destroy it or bury it in the ground. And at that point, I realized I really must make one, because they're trying to hide something. I'd come across so much disinformation on the internet before, so many different, you know, I'd learned to filter out disinformation. So I really thought, okay, I'll give this a go. And basically, you can find the instructions on the web quite easily, actually. There's quite a few people made them now, and there's lots of videos. I've made four of them. And basically what it is a resin metal base. You have metal shavings of different types of metals mixed together with liquid resin, and it sets, and you've got like a bucket mold. But inside the resin is metal tubes, and in the bottom of the metal tubes you've got double terminated crystals of quartz, and they have a positive and a negative side. The positive is the clearer side of the two points. And the positive side is pointing up. And you glue those in the bottom of the pipes, and they're fixed in place. And once it's all gone off, and it takes a few sessions, because you can only do so much resin at a time because it gets too hot. So basically you do one layer, and the pipes are parallel, vertical. And once it's all done, you add the additional lengths of the pipe. So in the end, it's about 2 meters high. And you've got a heavyweight base made of resin and metal fibers. And these six pipes, copper pipes I've got, but you can use any metal pipes, with the double turbinate crystals. And what happens is that all those metal fibers are held in the resin. They get excited and the electrons are all interacting and they're creating energy. And basically the crystals, which and crystals are used in computers, in watches, and, you know, they're recognized by industry. This isn't, you know, this is a legitimate tool to be using, material. And basically the chemtrails, when they're sprayed into the atmosphere, they seem to be, they appear to be negatively charged. And basically the whatever happens, I can't explain the actual science because I don't truly understand the science, but I know how it works because I watch it working. Basically they disrupt the chemtrails. I've heard it said that they take down the negative energy and replace it with positive energy. Now, it kind of makes sense, but when you see it, it totally makes sense. You know, I can't truly explain from a physics science point of view how it works, but I've seen it working. I see it working all the time. So when I first did this, I was completely amazed, really. And we felt absolutely fantastic as well, because the energy coming out of them is very positive energy. Orgone energy is a real energy that you can measure. It's not often talked about in science, but it is a real energy, and it makes you feel good.
Do you remember, like, I think it was maybe a couple of years ago or something, there was a lot of incidents, might not even be as long as that, there was a lot of incidences being reported, very strange occurrences of birds just falling from the sky, dead.
Still happens now, actually.
In Australia, one specific case, when these birds were given an autopsy, the bodies were found to be full of heavy metal and lead. Now, how does a bird that eats nectar out of wildflowers get heavy metal and lead in their body?
Well, okay, that's going to lead us to what's happening with our soil and what's happening with our environment. Basically, of course, they keep on spraying these heavy metals into the environment. They have an accumulative effect on the soil, and the soils are changing and the plants are changing. Now, what's happening is they're getting a build-up of these heavy metals, and slowly but surely the environment is changing. And as a response to that problem, you've got companies like DuPont and Monsanto and various other big...
Series.
Yeah, they are making aluminium-resistant seeds. Now, there's no need to make anything aluminium resistant, because aluminium is actually a very abundant metal in nature, but it's in a safe form. You know, aluminium is one of those materials. You can't destroy it. If you change it, it will alter into something else because it will lock on to something else, but it's in a safe form. But if you do nanoparticles, that's a different story, you know, because it's really at almost an atomic level. So when we've got these huge amounts of aluminium being sprayed into the atmosphere, it is changing the soil, which easily anyone can test this with a normal pH kit. And you will find that some people who grow food will be complaining that they're not getting as much from their food as they used to. Many people I've talked to, and in fact, I had a gardener from America contact me recently about chemtrails, because he has a massive audience of people. He's got a TV thing, and he's concerned about chemtrails because things are not growing as well as they should be. And the problem is, what happens is the pH changes, and then the normal foods cannot take up the nutrients they need to survive, and they start getting diseases and fungals and bacteria. And so it's showing already. There's also another problem with forest fires. You've probably been aware that basically since about 2000, we keep on hearing in the news year after year about various forest fires that are so intense and difficult to control all around the world, like in Greece or in California or in Australia or different locations. And this, they're far more intense and more aggressive than before. And that's because the nanoparticles of aluminium is actually an accelerant, and it's used in rocket fuel, and it was used in early trials for fuel for jets. And so it's very combustible. So these trees are breathing in or soaking up this aluminium from the soils. And it's getting into the trees, and when there is a fire, it becomes far more intense.
So
there's lots of evidence to prove that this is happening.
Yeah, with the soil being polluted with the genetically modifying process, and obviously with the chemtrails, if they're being sprayed everywhere and all that's like polluting the soil. So and the flowers that are ever growing out the soil, then that could make a lot of sense about why a lot of bees are dying off.
Oh, well, we've lost 50% of the bees worldwide, and in some places it's even higher. And to give you an idea, I'm not saying it's definitely them, but there's a reaction and there's a solution. And Monsanto have bought the leading a bee research company so that they can make GMO bees. Now, some people say that's a reaction because they're trying to say that it's their Roundup or their pesticides or whatever. But, you know, they're definitely intrinsically linked with spraying, because we know that Monsanto manufactured the Agent Orange that was used in Vietnam. And actually, there were many different sprays they used in Vietnam. And Monsanto made those. So we know that they are at least have a history of it. So we're quite certain they're making aluminium-resistant GMO seeds. And the seed line is not just for food. It's even for trees. So it's quite wide. So if they're genetically modifying bees, we know that bees are essential for the supply of food in the world. They propagate 70% of all food stuffs in the world. So, you know, food's going to get pretty ordinary if they destroy the bee population.
Yeah, what a horrifying thought, really, for humanity. If the bees go, then we only have a few more years, basically. Now, what's the legal situation regarding chemtrails? What kind of legislation are you aware of as regards them?
Well, I am aware of treaties like the Open Skies Treaties, where military planes are allowed to fly in other countries' airspace, but that's usually for reconnaissance purposes. There is actually a treaty to say you are allowed to fly over our airspace if you're just taking photographs. But there are a treaty. There is another treaty that says that you're not allowed to modify the weather for weapons. But, I mean, relative to geoengineering, the UK themselves in 2009/10, they did their fifth report, which is 140 page long, on the regulations on geoengineering. That's from the Science and Technology Committee. And this is an in-depth study. Now, remember, it's the fifth report. These reports are quite complex and they take a while to put together. So they've known about this for a long time. They've been considering it for a long time. And basically, in that 140 page document, when you start to read the summary right at the beginning, one of the paragraphs there says that the UN is the route by which they see the regulatory framework being put into place, but the UK government must take the initiative to push the agenda of geoengineering up the international agenda. So basically, the British government is very proactive about trying to create laws for geoengineering. And to give you an idea about that, you can go to www.srmgi.org SRMI.org. And what that is a government site that's been set up. It's called the Solar Radiation Management Government Initiative. Because solar radiation is one of the methods of geoengineering, and that's spraying the particles into the atmosphere that will supposedly reflect the sun away to save us all from being fried alive.
Okay, thanks. I'm sorry to cut you short there. I'm conscious of how fast this interview is going, and I've still got a bunch of things I want to ask you. So can we move swiftly on to HAARP? So could you maybe tell us what HAARP is, what does it stand for, and what is the capabilities of HAARP, and what do you think their main goals are behind using this technology?
HAARP stands for the High Active Aurora Research Program. And basically what that is using Tesla technology. It's about using different frequencies in the atmosphere to have different effects in the atmosphere. It's different reasons why they use HAARP, why they publicize it. It's a civilian stroke military operation. Initially, it's funded by the military. It's funded for communication purposes. They're basically, you can see around the horizon because you bounce your signal off the ionosphere. The ionosphere is the upper atmosphere. It's the last part of our atmosphere. It's about 300 miles up. It's an electromagnetic shield that's generated by the Earth that protects us from the solar radiation. Now, what they intended to do was to bounce a signal off the ionosphere and then bounce that around over the curvature of the Earth so that you could communicate anywhere on the planet, basically. Now, with HAARP, you can send extremely low frequencies through the ground. So you could search for oil, gas, nuclear weapons, bunkers under the ground, or whatever reason that they give that they want to do that. They can communicate with submarines. They can interfere with the climate. This is stipulated. I mean, I'll give you an example of what we can say without a doubt, because I've got a document here from the European Union. Now, the EU Parliament voiced its concerns about HAARP in 1999. Well, they did 1999. And basically, they were concerned because HAARP can be used as a weapon to create earthquakes, to create volcanic eruptions. They can use it for mind control, or they call it altering human behavior. They can create a drought region. They can deny a country rain, or they can flood a country with too much rain. They can create hurricanes, and they can steer hurricanes. I mean, the US have done that since 1947. They did a program called Operation Storm Fury, which was a 20-year program on how to steer hurricanes. So basically, they can create earthquakes, they can do volcanic eruptions, tectonic things, they can create tsunamis, they can create drought regions, they can create flood regions, they can create hurricanes, they can create tornadoes, they can do mind control, which they call altering human behavior. They can actually triangulate different installations and create something called a particle beam, which can destroy things. And when I say destroy things, I mean more destructive than a nuclear weapon. Basically, that's part of the Star Wars program. So the idea was that a missile could be coming in and they could destroy it. They can alter space weather by creating holes in the ionosphere. That's one of the bad side effects about using HAARP, is that there now are multiple holes in the ionosphere. Now, the ionosphere is our protective shield against radiation. Now, that radiation, without that shield, we would all die. So they are burning holes into the ionosphere and basically putting us all at risk so they can continue with their experiment or their weapons program. Another thing they can do is by putting up a tremendous amount of energy. We're talking 5.1 gigawatts, right? Now, if you think about that film with Back to the Future, whatever it is, and you've got that guy, he's going, what, 1.2 and 21 gigawatts, whatever it is. It's like a fraction. It's a quarter of what they're using to send up into the atmosphere. Now, when it gets up to the atmosphere, they can actually force multiply because the energy that's in the electromagnetic shield that is the ionosphere is much greater. So they can tap into that, and then they can direct that to any location they want. So that's how you can, if you do that by triangulating, you can make a tremendous amount of power. It's like harnessing lightning. So this is how dangerous HAARP is. It's basically the ultimate weapon.
That's disturbing, which I seem to be keeping seeing. It's just a thread of the whole topic we're covering tonight. There's just a lot of kind of very...
And this can be verified. You know, all the information I have gleaned, like I'd just like to reiterate that I am no more an expert than any other person. I don't claim to be. I'm just a concerned person that's done the research, and the research is there for everyone to find. You know, it's not top secret information. It's that you can glean this stuff from the internet. Admittedly, some of this stuff comes from the European Parliament. And some of this stuff comes from military sites that are publicly available. You can find this stuff. You just have to do a lot of searching.
I'm conscious that we've only got a few minutes left, so I just want to rapidly cut out a few questions I was going to ask you and move to the key ones. Like, for example, you're very active in campaigning against chemtrails, as we're aware here. You've recently just finished a chemtrail awareness tour in your Chugabim van, I believe, with a bunch of people. Do you want to tell us about that? What you done, where you went, how was it all received, and any other activism or you've been a part of or planning in the future, and maybe tell us how people can get involved as well?
Yeah, well, that's right, because, well, one of the things that we've all gone through these different processes of feeling sad, angry, depressed and everything else, and it is bad. You know, I've had my head and my hand is crying, my eyes out sometimes. But at the end of the day, you have to pull yourself together and realise, well, you know, I really want to do something. So when I was making all my videos, I seemed to get quite a following on YouTube, which is pretty good. In at that time, within 6 months, I had over 3,000 subscribers and, you know, hundreds of thousands of video views. And because of that, a really passionate woman who's so filled with energy, her name is Mona Norman, she contacted me and asked me, she said she was putting on a conference in London about chemtrails, and would I be happy to come and give a presentation? And I'd never done anything like this before. But at that time, I was actually getting quite frustrated just making videos and sharing information, commenting whilst I was making the videos, and I kind of felt like I'd reached my limit of what I could do there. So it was a great opportunity for me to do this conference. So I went to London, and before I'd done this, I'd already decided to paint up my van. Now I've got an LDV convoy long wheelbase van, that's an old post office van, and basically I painted it on every available surface with different signs and information and groups, because I belong to lots of different groups all around the world, and so there's lots of different names of groups and stuff like that, which gives people an opportunity to see that this is a worldwide concern, because there are literally groups in hundreds of groups all around the world, and they could see the big messages about chemtrails, stopping chemtrails, and it gives people an opportunity to ask me questions. So I drove over to London in the Chugaboom, which I call it. And the conference was absolutely wonderful. Following the conference, I met a guy called Terry Lawton, who's a long-term activist, and he's from Ireland, and he was part of the Girl Against Fluoride campaign, and he's very interested in chemtrails. And we got talking, and we decided to go out into the streets of London the following day, and we started handing out flyers, and it was pretty good. It was good to reach people that had not really come across this before and actually get information out. We had some flyers from the conference. So that was a great success. So following that, It was like, well, when are we going to do the next one? This was wonderful. It was very inspiring. We set up some groups with the people. There were quite a lot of people there, and a lot of people wanted to they came from different parts of the country, and they wanted to set up their groups. So basically different groups got set up because of that conference, and we linked up people, and you can actually make contact with people rather than just using the internet. So following that, it was like, well, let's do another one. And it was like, well, I've got to come from France. And Terry said he'd like to do a presentation as well. And he's coming from Ireland. So it's like, well, if we're going to make this journey, let's do more than one. Let's try and fit in another one. And then that developed into a tour. So we ended up doing six cities. So because these different groups are around, different people said, oh, well, can you come to our town and we'll get a venue and we'll set this up. So basically what happened was we arrived for the London GMO protest at Hyde Park. And then following that, we went to Maidstone, then to Glastonbury, Exeter, to Stroud, Nailsworth, Portsmouth and Brighton. So we would go to different places, and we went to the town hall at Glastonbury, and we went to the Phoenix Centre in Exeter, and different locations. Sometimes it was in a community centre, another time it was in a pub, but it was quite a big function room. And basically we went out into the streets before, and we flyered as many people as we could. We parked up with a van, we got banners out, and we got huge banners that are like a meter 50 high, and some of them are like 8 meters wide, of all the pictures of the different equipment that they use for spraying, because we've got pictures of the tanks inside planes, the chemical tanks, and connected with computers, and we've got pictures of the nozzles that they use for spraying, and basically in a picture you can see that they're spraying something. So it was a very good way to actually reach just normal people in the general public. Okay, so basically what we found was we were able to reach many, many people in the public. We've stimulated the council Glastonbury is starting up their own action group, and many other groups are being initiated because we went around raising awareness, and we basically took every opportunity we could. We got to speak on mainstream radio three times, and it was nothing but positivity. We've reached more people, and it's inspired us. So, you know, we want to do another tour. And we're in the process of so many people are requesting that we go to their town now. We're trying to organise ourselves, and we will be going on another tour.
Okay, thank you very much. Do you have any very final words, like just a final website to throw out very quickly just before I finish up?
Well, there's Kim Charles Project UK, and there is Skywatch UK, or UK Skywatch, actually. UK Skywatch, www.ukskywatch.com. .co.uk or chemtrailsprojectuk.com, and they're two good sites with lots of links. And also, I mean, if you want to go to geoengineering.watch.org, geoengineeringwatch.org or geoengineeringexposed.com, I mean, I would say, well, obviously for the Britain, we'll stay with the British people. I mean, they're fantastic sites anyway. Chemtrail Project UK and UK Skywatch.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Max. It's been a pleasure having you on. I'd love to have you on again in the future, perhaps with the rest of the people you're working with for this activism. Also, if you want to stay on for the next hour, you're more than welcome. And if you do, then we can maybe open the phone lines. We usually open the phone lines anyway. It's a Dark City show with a Dark City crew, so it's a different format, obviously. But people might have questions they want to ask you, so it's entirely up to you.
Well, I'd be happy if anyone wants to ask any questions. We'd be more
excellent.
Than happy to.
Yeah. Excellent. So the phone lines will be open, and thanks everybody for listening tonight. You were listening to Dawn's Diorama. Over and out. Good night.
They said we could not do it. They said it wasn't possible. But we did it. We created a free radio station to bring the people together and spread an alternative message from the mainstream. They tried to silence us. They tried to hack us. But we carried on. You cannot silence the truth. You cannot enslave freedom. You cannot stop a good idea. You cannot stop Dark City Radio. The crew is now bigger and stronger than ever before. We will not be kept off the airwaves. We will continue. This is not our radio. This is your radio. This is Dark City Radio.
This is your Dark City. This is your Dark City.
This is your Dark City.
This is your Dark City.
This is your Dark City.
This is your Dark City Radio.